Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the midterms are over and change is in the wind, particularly with the Mecklenburg County Commission, where Republicans are swept away. Another week, another gun at another CMS high school. Bojangles, home of sweet tea, fried chicken, and made-from-scratch southern biscuits, gets a northern accent. And Wells Fargo digs deeper, finds more problems, and apologizes again. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Morning.
Good morning.
And Oz Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, is back. Good morning to you.
Good to be here.
Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher for QCityMetro.com. Hello.
Howdy.
And Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he's senior staff writer.
Good morning, Mike.
All of us on the radio, as you can plainly tell, but also on Facebook Live, which will take a little effort on your part, I suppose, if you really want to see us.
We're worth it.
That's right. The midterms are over, and the blue wave anticipated by Democrats turned out to be a little different than they hoped, although it seems to be getting stronger as the week progresses, as they continue to count votes. But they captured more seats, particularly here in Mecklenburg. They also lost some contests that they thought they had a real shot at, including here in the 9th Congressional District, where Republican Mark Harris claimed victory early on Tuesday night.
We knew this was going to be a close race. Both camps talked about it. But once all the early and in-person votes were counted late last night, the results showed a clear win for Team Harris.
Well, that was on Tuesday night, and the results, I thought, seemed anything but clear, but it was incredibly close. He was ahead by less than 2,000 votes, I think, at the time, 1,860 to be exact. So why was he so quick to claim victory?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think one of the things is that we have all these close races now. That seems to be one of the tactics for a lot of people, is to go ahead and get out in front and say, hey, look, this is mine. I was surprised. I still haven't heard the reason, and I would love for someone to correct me or enlighten me, why there was not a challenge. I mean, he could have challenged. It was under the 1%.
It broke 49.4 for Harris, 48.7 for his opponent, Democrat Dan McCready. That's 1%. That's like, what is it, 0.7%. I think they're challenging a race in Georgia that's 0.8% away. McCready did wait till the next day to concede.
We may not have won this campaign, but that does not mean that we were wrong. And as long as there are people in power who thrive off our division, there is still work to be done. Today, it's okay to be disappointed. It's okay to be angry and sad and frustrated. But it is not okay to give up.
But didn't he? I mean, less than 0.7 separate the two of them. He could have asked for a recount.
He does have that right. It sounds like he is conceding there, and there's still an opportunity for him. What happens is they have the canvas, the certification of the vote. That is a week from today, and that will include everything that comes in. So still to be counted are absentee and provisional ballots. Absentee ballots, I think, can come in until the end of the day today. And so in that race and all these other really close ones, there's still an opportunity for candidates to make that decision. If these additional votes that come in—
You generally do not give a concession speech if you're going to challenge. That was what surprised me.
But if these other votes come in and it does substantially change that number, then there could be an opportunity for him to do it. It doesn't sound like he's going to do it. I mean, 1,800 votes, if he picks up a few hundred votes, that's not enough to really justify a challenge.
Given the fact that this was supposed to be an important race and one that the nation's eyes were on, although I didn't see a lot of it, talk about it on television on election night, since the Democratic Party, the National Party, was really hoping for this massive blue wave, are they not behind the scenes talking to McCready and saying, don't concede?
Well, I think they must have some idea about the numbers that it's just not going to move. Like David is saying, like maybe it moves a few hundred. Because I see no reason for him to go out there and concede unless they are confident that they just can't make up the deficit.
I wonder what they were doing behind the scenes, because Katie Peralta, who was at his headquarters, said he never came out and said anything, even— You know, you would think he would come out and say thank you to the volunteers, right, kind of charge them up and say, we just aren't going to have answers tonight. But basically, at the end of the evening, he sent a staffer out to say, okay, everybody go home, yeah. which is a weird way to handle that.
Glenn. I don't know if I've ever seen a recount that changed the early results substantially. Maybe it narrows the gap, but generally speaking, that initial count typically holds up in the recount. But I guess my question is, does a concession speech end it, or do the votes count?
Oh, well, no, certainly. I think the votes count. So if it did go the other way, I don't think that he has, I guess, you know, he hasn't canceled himself out in some way. But generally, if he waited that long to give a concession speech and then he gave one, they must be pretty confident that they're not going to make up the gap.
I mean, you look at all the results, you look at the precinct by precinct results, and you say, is there any chance that we have a possibility of getting more votes here, and how many? And with 1,800 votes, I think that's an awful lot to overcome.
For example, Rachel Hunt has not conceded, right. And she's, what, 52 votes? And now there's a big difference between 1,800 and 52. obviously.
You can do math.
Yeah.
As I said, I don't think we got mentioned very often, the 9th Congressional District on national television as a race that they were particularly excited about watching. And the next day, the day after Election Day, President Trump, of course, made his big press conference at the White House, and he took to task a lot of Republicans who did not embrace him and his offer to help. But he also talked glowingly about a lot of people whom he did campaign for, and he did campaign for Mark Harris. And I don't think he said a word about Mark Harris, right. But Harris certainly mentioned Trump on Tuesday night.
I am so appreciative of President Trump, appreciative of Donald Trump Jr. and Laura Trump, who all three came to this district twice and helped push us over the top.
Did the president's visits help do the trick for Mark Harris? Did it put the period on the end of the sentence for him, or would Harris have won anyway, given the way this district was gerrymandered and drawn? This is one of the contested districts, because they're all contested.
So many of the analysts that I've talked to are saying that this was always Harris's race to lose, that the way the district is drawn and the fact that it is Republicans held the seat before gave him an edge on it. I think it was up to Dan McCready to really win this race. And, you know, there's some talk about how he just wasn't out there enough. He wasn't out front enough. He didn't challenge Trump enough. I mean, Trump's name did not come up a lot during the campaign. And some folks in the Democratic side feel that he could have done more.
What I heard from more people was not the Trump effect, but the McCready effect, if you will. I've talked to people who went to the debates, who've heard the debates, who have talked with him at other events. And these were people who wanted to vote for him but said, I don't know what this guy stands for. They wanted him to be a little bit more outspoken for the things that he believed in. So, you know, there's a little bit of speculation about the effect Trump may have had.
It seems to me that the Democrats who won and won big were the ones that embraced Democratic ideals.
I was going to say, Mike, one of the things that strikes me about McCready is if you compare McCready to Beto O'Rourke, who didn't win but was very close, and he was certainly in a more—
So was Harris.
Yeah, no.
I mean, so was
McCready. But when you compare Texas to the 9th, I mean, that's a much heavier lift is Texas. And what I mean by that in terms of the comparison is Beto O'Rourke certainly embraced what he thought, being a progressive, all those kinds of things. And McCready did not.
And that's what I'm hearing.
I think Glenn is exactly right. I think that did cost him, that blank slate. It was almost as though, look, I have the perfect resume. I'm from Central Casting. That's all you need to know. And I don't think that was enough.
What we really knew was that he wasn't going to support Pelosi.
Yeah.
And he's not going to vote for her. He was right about that.
I don't think she needs his vote.
It was interesting to look at the county breakdown map, because I had not actually realized that there were 8 counties represented in that district. Yeah. And Mark Harris won 2 of them, Union County and Bladen County. But he won them by big enough margins to offset the other blue counties, including Mecklenburg.
So the 9th is one of those districts that the courts wanted to redraw prior to the election and then said, no, there's not time to do it. So it's going to be redrawn. Is it possible that in 2 years, when the winner of this, and presumed the presumed winner is Mark Harris, runs again, it will be a completely different district?
It's likely that it will change. I mean, these elections this year in the congressional districts in North Carolina are the the illegal gerrymandered districts, but it was determined that they couldn't be redrawn in time for this election. And so, you know, next time around, many of them will be redrawn. And I think we'll be in the same situation here where you have an incumbent who's running in a who's not that well known yet, but is running in a district that is redrawn.
When you look at Pittsburgh, where the courts did order them to redraw gerrymandered districts ahead of the election, I think the Democrats took 3 out of 4, something like that. But the only wild card with North Carolina, and for that matter for the nation, is what will the Supreme Court do? We're still waiting for the Supreme Court to chime in to say whether politically gerrymandering is unconstitutional.
And just as an aside, there was a case this week, the Maryland case, that came back, and the Ninth Circuit decided that, in fact, it was politically gerrymandered, and that's going to set up this going to the Supreme Court probably before the North Carolina case gets there.
So when does the legislature break out their crayons and redraw these districts?
2020, right?
After the census.
Yes. So, I mean, that's why the next election, I know every election is the most important one in the history of creation, but that one is pretty big. I want to go back to Dan McCready just real quickly, though. Remember, he's, what, 39 years old? Mm-hmm. First campaign. So it's, you know, if he made mistakes or the mistakes that he made, I would expect to see him run again. I don't know if it's this seat or something else.
So voter turnout was pretty high here and around the country. Many came to cast a vote for or against Donald Trump. What role did that play in causing the Republicans to lose their supermajority in the legislature? Was it due to Donald Trump, or was it due to what many perceived as legislative overreach?
I would say that if there was a blue wave in North Carolina, it was at the legislature this time around. The Democrats spent a lot of money. I think they raised $15 million. And in some of these races, they were either over $1 million or close to $1 million in spending on the Democratic side, which is unheard of. So they really put a lot of effort into this. And I do think that voters responded. I mean, the turnout was I think, 52% statewide. Well,
what were they saying? Were they saying no to Donald Trump, or were they saying no to Republicans who have really taken the horse by the reins here and galloped hard for several years?
I think in those legislative races, the push by Democrats was to break that supermajority. There was a lot of discussion about it. And, you know, if we look at some of the races in our area, Senator Jeff Tarte in North Mecklenburg lost to Natasha Marcus, a Democrat, and that was something that was easy to see coming in the final weeks. The polls were going her way.
And that was also in a significantly redrawn district.
Yes.
That's right. And it was redrawn to a little bit more advantage to Democrats, but still a Republican district. So voters did speak out against Republicans. A couple of seats in Guilford and Wake County also went to Democrats that hadn't been that way before. In our area, Dan Bishop kept his seat, but that's the only one around here.
Okay. So they broke the supermajority, which means that it's not veto-proof anymore. The governor can veto things and not necessarily have it immediately overridden. And the governor said that results showed that North Carolinians were sending a strong message to the legislature that, quote, they want their state leaders to find more common ground and work with the governor. Really?
and
is that what they said?
The Republican legislative leaders said that it was a clear mandate to continue
right.
the policies.
Yes. And, they referred to those amendment items as the mandate.
So locally, Democratic State Senator Jeff Jackson handily won re-election, but Republican District 41 State Senator Jeff Tarte lost. Newcomer Natasha Marcus, who shared these thoughts on why she believes she won.
The district lines have been significantly redrawn. So that was a big part of it, and that's what gave us hope from the beginning, that if we ran a strong race and ran a race with dignity and spoke to the issues and didn't get distracted, that we could win this race. And
so,
I think that's exactly what we did.
So when we come back from the break, we'll talk about whether she's right about that. What was that vote about? Was it what she just said, or was it Jeff Tarte's inability or unwillingness to try to stop the I-77 toll lanes? More in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg is here from the Business Journal, and David Borax from WFAE News. So Natasha Marcus was one of those Democrats who beat an incumbent Republican, State Senator Jeff Jackson. Was it what she said a moment ago, if you recall what she said
Jeff Tart.
I always confuse the two, and I don't know why.
They're Jeffs.
They're completely different.
They're Jeffs.
But anyway, was it that, or was it Tart's inability or unwillingness to stop or try to stop the I-77 toll lane?
I think it's a little bit risky to try and discern voter motivation to narrow it down. Although, Tart is interesting because he flip-flopped on 77 in the tolls, but when he decided that the tolls were bad, he spent a lot of time talking about it and pitching ideas and bills and things. So I would love to know the answer to that. Maybe somebody else here has the answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure the tolls was the only thing that was a factor in this election. I mean, it was a big one. A lot of Marcus's campaign materials focused on linking Jeff Tart with Pat McCrory, and if you remember back 2 years ago, McCrory lost in a campaign that was probably all about the tolls. In North Mecklenburg, voters who normally would have voted Republican voted for Roy Cooper, and there's many people think that made a difference in the election. But she was also talking about women's issues. Remember, she's among a wave of Democratic women who ran for office this time and raised a lot of money, and she talked a little bit about the Kavanaugh case and made an appeal to Democratic voters to come out and support somebody new in that seat.
House District 103, that's the one with Bill Brawley and Rachel Hunt, the former governor's daughter, and it's 52 votes separate the two of them. Has Rachel Hunt conceded yet?
She has not, and 52 votes, easily well under 1% for a recount. I expect to see that here. I would not expect her to concede until that's done. As I said earlier, you know, absentee votes are still coming in. They'll be counted, provisional ballots. There's a good chance that this could flip, although many times in these situations, we do not see the results change from election night. So it'll be interesting. And we will find out next Friday.
And in House District 98, Democrat Christy Clark beat Republican incumbent John Bradford by 333 votes, I think, at last count. Is that being contested in any way?
That one's another one that could be. I think it depends on what the final vote turns out to be. That may be a little bit much for a chance for Christy Clark, but she's another one who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and if there's any glimmer of hope there, I'm sure they will challenge it.
In South Mecklenburg County, Representative Andy Doolin was defeated by Democrat Brandon Lofton. Was that because of Doolin, the accusation that came out late in the race of Doolin having a DUI in Ohio, which led Jeff Tart to say
Dan Bishop said he should
get out
step
of the
aside.
Or was it because of changing demographics?
Yeah, I think it was more changing demographics. I think, again, we're talking about suburbs. We're talking about college-educated women. We're talking about the year of the woman. I think all those things were much bigger factors. Even though the Doolin story was big sort of in our circles, I don't think it really resonated beyond that too much.
Yeah, I think you have to look at the big picture. I think Eric is right. When you look at what happened in the Charlotte suburbs, this followed a pattern.
Yeah.
It, you know, there may have been some people who decided to vote against him because of that, but it's not beyond what we're seeing throughout the region.
As David said a minute ago, and anybody's going to spin this any way they want to, Republicans in the legislature called this a clear mandate from voters to continue with Republican policies. But is it fair to say that here and around the country where Democrats did make inroads, they did so in heavily gerrymandered situations?
Yeah.
So the vote, had it not been for the gerrymander, might have been a complete washout of
Yeah, because that's a good point, Mike. When you look nationally at the margin that Democrats accrued, it is similar to what Republicans, for example, did in 2010. The difference, of course, being that these districts are heavily gerrymandered, and so making gains and inroads is much more difficult. A lot of votes are wasted on the Democratic side in these urban areas where they're just racking up these huge wins, but the votes, of course, only go so far.
You know, the Republicans took control of the legislature in 2010, running in districts that had been gerrymandered by Democrats, and they did it. They succeeded. I think the difference now is that the gerrymandering has gotten so much more
precise,
technical, that they can do it in ways that they couldn't. And so the Democrats really didn't have as good a chance of taking over. Now,
and the
go ahead.
And the Republicans also took over in 2010 because the Democrats that year largely stayed home. That was 2 years after Obama was elected. I think there was a lot of excitement among the Democrats, and they just simply didn't turn out. Mm. And that wasn't the case this year. Republicans did turn out. Republicans turned out. Democrats turned out. So I think the Democrats have to take a little bit of their blame for 2010 as well as—
And I think you're absolutely right, Glenn. And there's no question Democrats became very complacent in 2010. They kind of thought all their problems were solved in 2008. And going back to this year, look, in North Carolina, it's still 10-3 in Congress in favor of Republicans. The vote was 50-48. That shows you the importance of those districts that were redrawn.
I was just going to take note of the fact that this time Democrats were not complacent and they were much more organized. I mean, if you go precinct by precinct around Mecklenburg County, you will see new Democratic organizations that have been built, some new blood in there, some old blood as well. They had people going door to door, doing telephone calling in a way that we haven't seen for a while from the Democrats. So there was really a concerted effort to get back in the game.
And there was definitely a blue washout in Mecklenburg County because not only do you now have a Democratic-led city government and city council, but now we have a completely Democratic county commission. All three Republican members were swept away. Elaine Powell, Susan Harden, Susan Rodriguez McDowell, all defeated Republicans. Jim Puckett, Matthew Ridenour, and Bill James. Puckett and James have been political figures here for a very long time. Both of them have generated their share of controversy over the years. Not so much for Bill James recently. He's been very quiet, but he still went down in defeat, and he shared, and so did Matthew Ridenour, who's been steady and pretty quiet as well, and he shared one factor he believes played a role.
I had one person walk up to me during early voting and said, you know what, you're a nice guy, I like a lot of what you've done, but I can't vote for any Republicans this year, so I've got to vote against you. That's hard to hear.
How much of that went on around the country, do you think?
It's hard to tell.
I can't
but
vote for you.
I believe that was significant. I think a lot of people, especially those swing voters, just decided that they were not going to vote for Republicans this year. I think people understand that one-party rule is not good. It's not good for good governance. It's not good on the national level, and if it's allowed to continue on the county commission, it will not be good. So, I think this was a corrective measure that this was a national corrective measure, and locally some of the county commissioners got caught up in it.
Yeah, and now to that point, now we see how 9-0 works, and there are already plenty of people that are nervous. Even Pat Cotham, the Democrat who's reelected, told me that she feels a lot of pressure to be effective because of the situation that they're facing.
The
now.
Observer, largely regarded by many people on the right as a liberal newspaper, even a Democratic newspaper, particularly on its editorial page, called what happened at the county commission level a blue wave that is bad for Charlotte. Essentially, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and the absence of leaders of one party to keep the other party in check is a bad thing. That's what happened in Washington, many people believe. That's what happened in Raleigh. Will it happen here?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen, one of the great contradictions of Bill James is that he could be a spokesperson for bigotry, but he could also be a spokesperson for open government, and there were times when he was really the one pushing them. So I do think there is, just from a reporter's point of view, I'm not part of the editorial board, but that you often see that having somebody who is a bit at odds with the majority can be a corrective and can be the person saying, let's not all just get complacent and go in the back room and make our decisions. I think the counterpoint to that would be that these Democrats are not necessarily monolithic in personality or style. There may be enough creative tension to keep them a bit balanced.
One quick point about Bill James. I think he didn't campaign at all. I think he spent $42 on his campaign. And, you know,
money well spent.
I think yeah, that's right.
It's an argument here for a little heavier campaigning in those
Dinner
commission
or
races.
Campaign.
But in that Observer editorial, I think one thing that caught my eye was that that they pointed to concerns about the way that the Democrats have run the county commission and the school board. They pointed to the school board and possible lack of transparency. I know you've covered the school board, and that's been a concern there, as something that we need to watch out for over the next term here.
There was something else that happened around the country, and the race for county commission here is certainly an example of it. Elaine Powell, Susan Harden, Susan Rodriguez McDowell. What do they all have in common?
Yes.
They're
yes.
all women, and in Q City Metro, you wrote, Glenn, a wind of change is blowing, and women will lead the way. Talk about that.
Absolutely. Across the nation, I was sitting there watching the election results come in, and I was just blown away by how many women were first time candidates were winning nationally. I was amazed by how many of them have military backgrounds. They've served in the armed services, and whether it's local or whether it's national, something is happening. Something is happening here. I remember watching the women's marches. I attended two, and
That's where it started, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. And I was wondering, is this going to translate into something real and permanent? Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have the answer to the first part. Definitely real. We'll see how permanent it is.
There were also in North Carolina at least six constitutional amendments on the ballot. All but two passed, and those were the ones that all the living governors came out against. Was their opposition what swayed the vote or even just brought people's attention to them?
I think it at least brought attention. I think that those two probably failed because it looked like a blatant power grab to a lot of people. This was the Republican legislature that has dominated politics in this state trying to take some pretty important powers away from a Democratic governor, and I think that voters got that message, and a majority of them said they didn't want that.
I thought it was impressive in that it showed that people were paying attention, because often, you know, beyond sort of the signature race, people just, you know, check, and you had one party saying vote for them all and one party saying nix all six. And people evidently thought about what those were and made a decision.
And there were Republicans in that group who voted against these. And that was another indication of kind of the broad opposition to these.
They were kind of short. Those two amendments, I think, were kind of short-sighted because political tides change
so fast.
And if you suddenly find yourself in the minority, why would you want that amendment? You wouldn't want that amendment.
It
was an attempt to lock in some more power for the Republican
majority. But it's only
temporary.
So, go ahead.
Well, one of the amendments we haven't talked about is the voter ID.
I was coming to that right now. Go right ahead and talk about it.
I didn't vote for the voter ID amendment for a number of reasons, but I'm glad it passed. I think we need to get that off of, you know, I think we need to get that behind us. Voter ID is inevitable. It's inevitable throughout the nation.
Well, most of the country believes that we should have it. I think it's 74% of voters across the country believe in voter ID. The problem here, it seemed to me, was the fact that the enabling legislation for this amendment that we voted yes for has not been written, so we
which
don't
is why,
know what.
Which is why I didn't vote for it.
Right, it's all in the details.
Exactly, it's all in the details.
So we voted blind. What are we likely to get?
Well, I think, and I'll let Glenn pick this back up, but I think that based on the track record of this legislature, the leadership of this legislature, I think it's going to be as restrictive as possible and probably as difficult to navigate for lower-income people, for minority people.
Well, can that then be challenged in the courts? We've said yes constitutionally to voter ID. Can the language, the law itself that enables that, be challenged by a court?
I would imagine that it could. I'm not a...
Everything can be challenged. Yeah. You just don't know if the challenge will prevail.
Right. And remember, I mean, they've tried this now several different ways, so the
idea here is that now they have a mandate from the voters to do this, even
because
though
they
don't know what the mandate is.
Because you wrote, Glenn, in Q City Metro, that make no bones about it, you said, voter ID is all about voter suppression.
Absolutely. We've gone more than 240 years without voter ID. We've never had any indication of widespread voter fraud in this nation. It was only after black and brown people began to really show political power that the right began to demand voter ID. Yes, it's about suppressing the vote, as is gerrymandering, as are moving precincts out of black areas. This is how it's part of a much broader strategy for the Republicans to get and maintain power as their numbers continue to shrink.
And I just have to always mention when we talk about this, nonpartisan study after nonpartisan study shows that it's voter fraud is not a problem. The only area where you really have concern is mail-in votes. That's the only area where
that's the area they aren't concerned about.
And that's
about.
The area that has not ever been addressed in any of these efforts. So make of that what you will.
Okay. As is normally the case, Charlotte voters overwhelmingly said yes to bonds, millions of dollars in bonds, $223 million in bonds, to fund affordable housing, transportation, and infrastructure. What do we get for our yes votes on infrastructure and transportation?
You get roads, you get sidewalks, you get greenways, and you get it in various neighborhoods around town. And I think, Mike, you started that off with the introduction of these usually pass. I think you said that.
I did.
Okay. So it's not a surprise.
You have to keep listening.
No, I know. I just want to make sure I wasn't putting words in your mouth.
25 minutes left.
That's right. Help me. But this is a consistent pattern in Charlotte.
So and those neighborhood improvement bonds, they're going to fund things like repaving roads, landscaping, new street lighting, updating intersections, parks, that sort of thing. And that's something that kind of lifts everybody's spirits.
So among these bonds was $50 million for affordable housing, not to build it, but to provide incentives for developers to include it in their new developments, and I guess to help some landlords decide to stick with it. I don't know. That took the amount from the traditional $15 million to $50 million, but some people say there's no guarantee that developers will take the bait on this, and one letter to the editor suggested that the money go to Habitat. That's not part of the plan, but could that work? Just spend the $50 million and give it to Habitat?
That's an interesting idea. I mean, that's not going to happen. I thought the story maybe a week or two ago that the Observer—
because they will build affordable housing.
Affordable housing. The story that the Observer did a couple of weeks ago about the disparity with the people most in need of affordable housing as compared to what's been funded was very interesting. I think that's going to be watched much closer now that you've seen the tripling in the funding.
So we have a minute. We have a minute left in this segment. In Gaston County, they too had referenda on the ballot. One dealt with alcohol sales in the unincorporated areas of the county, which have to this point been dry. There were four options to choose from: beer, wine, mixed drinks, and ABC stores. What were they being asked? They all passed. What does it mean for liquor sales?
Well, again, I came to Gaston County in the late 80s when the towns were approving alcohol sales. It was very dramatic, very contentious.
Right.
This is the little bits of the county that are left, and I think we said yes, please, to all of them. It was not terribly controversial this time around.
Okay, so the ice is already clinking in the glasses.
We found out that what we got was bars and restaurants, and
right.
We kind of like them.
Another week, more guns in schools. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about some other things that have made the news but maybe have skipped your radar because of everything else, including Bojangles being sold. Oh, my gosh. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on this Friday with David Borax from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, where he's a senior staff writer, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, QCityMetro.com, and Ann Doss Helms here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. 2 weeks ago, one student shot and killed another at Butler High in Matthews. The next day, a gun was found at Garinger High School. This week, a gun was found at Hopewell High School. Message sent. And this week on this program, CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox, who has thus far resisted recommendations to install metal detectors and or wand students, is reconsidering, and he explained his reasoning for his resistance.
I'm not here to say we're not going to do some of these things. I am here to say that, you know, a lot of people are offering solutions that they believe are simple and straightforward, and they're not.
He is now reconsidering that initial reluctance to install those things. What makes these things so complicated?
Well, we've talked about this many times, and I think he addressed it on the show also. You have these big open campuses, multiple buildings. The only way to really secure them is to somehow contain a campus with multiple buildings,
funnel
everyone through one entry point, screen them somehow, whether it's searching bags, whether it's see-through bags, you know, whether it's wanding them with metal detectors. and then keep them within those confines, because otherwise you're screening them at every door, and that's
and that
massive.
takes time to do as
it
well.
It does.
So do they shorten the school day to have people come and go? How do they do it?
I think that's all the question that's out there, and we don't know any details about what he's considering yet. This was on Wednesday night at the school board meeting that he said he's now willing to consider measures that he had rejected. He was going to meet with his staff first thing on Thursday morning.
Right.
They're going to work out some details. He says he doesn't want to bring anything public until he's met with the principals on, I think, the 13th of November. So
CMS and other districts around the country have been asking students, if you see something, say something, and many times that has worked, but it did not work, evidently, in the case of the Butler shooting. Again, Clayton Wilcox on this program on Monday.
This was one of those things where we didn't have that kind of actionable intelligence, and that's another thing that caught it. We maybe had gotten a bit complacent in that kids would tell us.
However, I heard from a source this week that they may have known something was going on, because when this incident happened at Butler, they immediately locked down Rocky River High.
I have not heard anything about that. But it is common to lock down nearby schools. And okay, they're saying that these three gun incidents are not connected. That's obviously one of the things you wonder, if there is a beef between a group of students.
Right.
Does it include students from other schools? You know, is there anything? They are saying there's no indication that all of this is connected, but I certainly don't know all the details.
So Clayton Wilcox at that school board meeting said that he's going to look at emergent technologies for school security. Was he specific about what those technologies might be?
He was not, which is interesting, because the things he's been open about, I think, are what you would call more of the emergent technologies, the more advanced cameras, the alarms. But when I asked him afterwards, are you specifically talking about metal detectors or searches, he said yes.
So in the immediate aftermath of what happened at Butler, the superintendent said it was an incidence of bullying. It stemmed from bullying, but Matthews police now say they have uncovered no evidence of bullying. What they do know, they say, is that this stems from an ongoing conflict between the suspect and the victim, relating back to an incident at a Harris Teeter parking lot on the previous Friday. This happened on a Monday. If not bullying, was it just a disagreement between two students? Was it something else? Or well, do we know?
I don't think we'll know for sure unless and until there's a trial and all the evidence comes out.
Gang-related activity, perhaps?
Have not heard that. Again, you can't be sure, but I've not heard that. You know, as much as we as reporters hate to hear people come out and say we can't comment on an ongoing investigation, this kind of illustrates why people say that, because I think Dr. Wilcox came out and said what was on his mind and on his heart. I don't think he fully grasped that he was sort of implicating the dead student, which I think has been a real sore point for a lot of people in the community. He probably did not intend to, although you can never be sure.
And he's been walking it back carefully.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, I think he has some remorse for those remarks. He didn't go to the funeral because he felt that he had created a situation where it would be inappropriate for him to go. And there we are.
And which he did talk about. This is another tragedy, another school tragedy, and people get very upset for obviously 100% good reasons. But police have pointed out to me, at least, that this happens every day in the community outside of a school building, and no one talks about it at all.
Not every day, but far too frequently. He's absolutely right. And it's often the same type of killing. Young people who have a beef with one another who decide to settle those disagreements with a gun.
Yeah.
You know, we're at a point now where we're skittish about this. I mean, there was this case in Wilmington this morning,
right,
in Pender County, actually, where some faulty equipment on the roof was making a noise that sounded like gunshots. Somebody called it in. The school went on lockdown, and, you know, there's been turmoil there today. Probably not going to have school there.
Well, we had the Journey cassette that was thought to be a bomb briefly. Everybody, for obvious reasons, is really skittish.
Yeah.
Air on the side of caution.
It does make you think. I get blasé about reporting, oh, there were, you know, 12 gun incidents. There were 17 guns at schools. And it's almost like, oh, nobody got shot. It's not a big deal. But you think about the stress that the students and the faculty are going through when you get that tip that somebody's on your campus with a loaded gun, as happened at Hopewell. I think that the Garinger gun was also loaded. You know, this is really traumatic for a lot of people.
There have been 300 mass shootings so far this year, and yeah, we're not even into the end of the year yet.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Mike. As much as we are all skittish, on the other hand, We have this horrible situation in California, and it's big news, but in a way, it's not the same kind of big news.
Here we go again.
Right, yeah.
In fact, I posted on Facebook. I got up that morning, and I heard about it from someone, and I went online, and the New York Times was playing it halfway down the page, and CNN wasn't talking about it at all. Yeah. It's almost becoming routine.
So very quickly, one more thing about CMS. They've decided they're not going to change the boundaries in the face of this possibility that municipalities may start their own charter schools. At least that's the plan right now. Mary McCrae, the school board chair, said there are no votes tonight, next week, next month, or next year. And Clayton Wilcox said he's not recommending any changes.
Yeah, and this was always a bit of political theater. I would have guaranteed going into it that Dr. Wilcox's report would be something along the lines of, look at how complicated and messy this would be. And the board's response would be something along the lines of, thanks for the input, we'll pass this along to the advisory committee. It is interesting to note that the act, the resolution scheduled this, and it was all along they were calling for it to be presented at the last October board meeting. Coincidentally enough, the last one before the election. And because of the Butler shooting, they postponed it until just after the election. I don't believe the substance would have been any different. It would have been really interesting to see if the tone might have been different, if there might have been a little more emphasis on, because this was about calling people's attention to some of these things and saying, you know, don't take advantage of, or, you know, don't forget about what you've got. We have a countywide school district. People are not localized within their little town schools. They're going, you know, Charlotte kids are going to school in the suburbs. Suburban kids are going to school in Charlotte. A lot of you like it that way. So it was always designed to be sort of a pointing out that there are no easy solutions to crowding and that this idea of town schools is not really practical.
So, moving on, Bojangles, famous chicken and biscuits, being sold again. It was founded in the 70s here in Charlotte. It's homegrown. Who bought them?
A couple of investment firms from Wall Street bought them. It was a 15% more than the shares were trading for, which was good if you're an investor. What's going on here, Mike, is really this is a company that's been operating as a public company, kind of in the spotlight. It hasn't been doing so well recently. I think its most recent quarter, the profits were down like 70%.
Yeah.
Investors
despite
want to return for their money.
Despite it always being bow time. How can that be?
And so
apparently the watches aren't working for some people.
The company has been taken private, as they say now, and that means that there won't be quarterly earnings reports that we can all look at, and they can work on strategies to try and turn things around.
So they made their name on Southern Fried Chicken, Southern Sweet Tea, and Southern Made from Scratch Biscuits. Here's the Southern reaction to the chain's new ownership.
Hey, this stuff's made in New York City.
New York City!
Like I told you, Mike, it's all unsweet tea from here on out.
Which is actually another commercial. Another thing. All right, Wells Fargo, another mea culpa from them. What is it this time?
They had more errant loan processing than originally reported in August. They had about, I think it was 250 more people affected. And this is just continuing, Mike, a years-long slog at this point that has led to the ouster of a CEO already. Senator Elizabeth Warren has asked for the current CEO to be removed. And this week, Maxine Waters, the California congresswoman, who will now be the head of the House Financial Services Committee, referred to fraudulent activities at Wells Fargo as one of her priorities. So there's a lot going on over there. So
and this is a story about people who've lost their houses
right.
because of errors. And so Wells has set aside a few hundred million dollars to try and make amends there.
Well, let's talk about that. 870 customers who are going through foreclosure and incorrectly denied or not offered loan modifications are what we talk about. 545 of those customers ultimately lost their homes. The bank apologized. So what does this mean for the customers? What is Wells going to do for them?
Well, I think they are trying to modify, as they say, help correct that. I guess help them get their homes back. I don't know. They have not given particulars. Do they compensate them? I'm not sure exactly.
In other cases, they have provided compensation. I think that's what we'll have here, too.
This came to light because the bank is policing itself. This did not come from outside investigators. The bank fessed up to this. Are they doing a better job of policing?
Well, they're doing more of a job, Mike, because they're under a lot of pressure. Remember, the Fed took the unprecedented step of limiting their asset growth. They have multiple investigations going on, so they are motivated to clean all this up. By the way, the other thing that was disclosed is this may not be the end. They might find more loan problems with homeowners. So, yes, this is a mess.
Down the street, just down Tryon Street from where we sit right now, Erica is in trouble. Bank of America is facing a trademark suit over their website and mobile app virtual assistant. This poor woman doesn't even exist. Erica.
Alexa is laughing somewhere.
Eric Underwood, founder of my24hournews.com, something we all are so familiar with.
Yeah, here, it's right here.
Registered E-R-I-C-A with periods in between the letters as the trademark for his virtual assistant in Georgia in 2010. How could the Bank of America not have uncovered this in their trademark processes?
That's a good question. He sent a couple of letters, right, according to the report, cease and desist. The bank called it, I think they called it something like
extortion.
Extortion, yes. Something subtle like that. So that's a good question, Mike. I guess that will come out in the legal case.
Speaking of extortion.
a segue.
While the battle is continuing to be waged over the I-77 toll lanes, this region's first toll road is set to open on November 27th. It's the first highway toll project in Charlotte. Why have we heard so little about this Monroe Expressway?
This is a project that's been in the works for years, and I think you have a situation where US 74 through Monroe is just a parking lot every day, like almost all day long. And this road is going to go around that. It's going to give people another way to do it. One reason we haven't heard as much about it is because this is the state doing it. It's not a private company. That's been a big issue in the I-77.
Cheaper tolls. And I think another reason we haven't heard about it is that, I mean, let's be honest, it's kind of off the beaten path for a lot of the newsmakers and people who matter.
So it opens November 27th. Tolls will range 14 to 15 cents per mile and be collected electronically using NC Quick Pass, which I believe you can also use on the toll lanes.
It's the same transponder.
And you have to buy those transponders, don't you?
You can get one for free.
You can.
You can buy one that works in more states, but if you just need the one to go on that road, you can get it
and
free.
And if you don't get it, what happens?
They will take a picture of your license plate and send you a bill in the mail, and it'll cost you 35% more.
Okay.
Transponder chat brought to you by.
One person has died in North Carolina as a result of a multi-state outbreak of hepatitis A, and it was in the paper this morning that if people ate in the recent past at the Hickory Tavern.
Village Tavern.
Village Tavern. In the South Park area, that you ought to go get a vaccination for this. This is spread through, food, and there are 20 cases. What are the symptoms? And what's the treatment? Is it just getting the shot? Do we know?
Some of these are not necessarily serious, but it also can be fatal, depending on your health condition. The symptoms I'm not really sure about, but this is something that can be prevented with vaccinations. And in the cases that we've seen, both in this one and the one last summer at the restaurant out by the airport, they've done vaccinations immediately afterwards. And I guess one of the lessons here is if you haven't had a hepatitis A vaccination right now, go get one.
I know they're going to talk about this in 20 minutes, but I want to talk about it just briefly because I've got reporters all around me. President Trump was clearly irritated at his press conference, post-election press conference. He got into several contentious exchanges with several reporters, including CNN's Jim Acosta, who he called a rude, terrible person. And shortly thereafter, the White House revoked Jim Acosta's credentials. What's your take on that? What's your take on the conduct of Jim Acosta and the result of that outburst?
First of all, I think we need to separate what Jim Acosta has been doing from this action. I think it's of great concern any time the White House decides to take away access to a reporter. Now, he has been a kind of a outspoken, loudmouth reporter. He's, he's the kind of person that, Republicans love to hate because he has had several encounters with President Trump this way. But again, we have to look at the situation and Trump's attitude toward the press in general.
I think we have a right as journalists to attend press conferences. We don't necessarily have a right to be called on. And when we are called on, we ask for a follow-up. But the person who's running the press conference can say yes or no. So I think there's blame to go around.
Meanwhile, for people who want to put this on their calendar, the Man of Gold is returning to the intersection of Providence and Providence, Queens and Queens, after more than a year of being off his post, not directing traffic. He's been repaired. He was hit by a car.
Hugh McManaway.
Welcome back, Hugh.
Yes.
And he'll be put up, I believe, next week.
That's right. Hugh got it.
With a retaining wall to protect him from future damage from car accident. Why people run into that statue is beyond my comprehension. He's way away from the intersection. Unlike the real Hugh McManaway. David Borax, Ann Doss Helms, Glenn Birkins, Eric Spanberg. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.